In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
Well, Dame Julie Andrews, welcome back to Movies and Musicals. Great to talk to you again. We last met when you were here for the Dublin International Film Festival in 2015. So as with part one of your memoir, with this follow-up, you've given us another page turner, that's for sure. The book begins with Mary Poppins, and I suppose not a bad day when Walt Disney himself wants you to play the lead in his latest film. We know Walt had quite a fraught relationship with Mary Poppins author P.L. Travers, but you seem to get on really well with him.
Yes, I don't think it was necessary. Walt was, you know, supremely tactful and decent and a gentleman, and I probably wasn't too much his fault with Pamela Travers, who was charming but understandably protective about her property, and I can understand it, but he gave her so many assurances, and it took him a long time to get the rights to the books.
The first bit of trivia you give us about this film, Julie, just a few pages in, made me laugh out loud, and that was that Dick Van Dyke, as we know, struggled a little with the Cockney accent. You tell us in chapter one that the nationality of the man who helped him out with his accent was?
Irish.
Irish.
Yes, that's right. I had to think for a minute because I was helping as well as much as I could.
Yes, you say that it was an Irish actor, J.P. O'Malley, who voiced indeed several of the animated characters in Mary Poppins, who tried to coach him.
Yes, he did, and was a lovely guy. But I don't quite know how that worked, Aideen, but there you are.
You mentioned that it was a learning curve for you to work out the difference between recording a Broadway cast album, normally done after the show, and in this case it was different because you were going to record the songs before filming. How did you find that?
Everything about film was so completely different to being on stage. You obviously, being on stage, you're in the moment. You start at the beginning and go to the end, and everything is in full figure, and you have to think about that. But you put it to bed, so to speak, every night in performance. But with a film, you hold the entire film in your head, and you could start in the middle and shoot the ending and maybe shoot the beginning, as I did in Sound of Music, at the very, very end of the movie.
You say with Mary Poppins, in terms of a first film to make, that it just taught you so much in a short period of time.
Well, it was such a complicated film with all the special effects and live action and animation and so many tricks. And it took a long time. I learned very quickly the patience that's required to be on set while very important things are going on. And so you wait and it's like being asked to get ready for a birthday party in your best dress. And then you sit and wait until you're asked to get up and make it right.
And of course, you were working out what was required vocally, say for an action sequence or if you were in front of a giant yellow screen.
That's right. Well, the recording side of it, which is what you were asking, is you have to know or anticipate at least what kind of movement you'll be doing. Are you breathless? Are you having a riotously good time? Are you quiet and reflective and sending a child to sleep? And you have to try to imagine. Sometimes it's impossible to, but a lot of the time, if you have choreography and you've been rehearsing it, you can get an idea of what's required. But it's not that easy at times.
I love in this book how you go into detail on the various songs, and we'll come to The Sound of Music in a moment. But just staying for with Mary Poppins, you mention, of course, you know, Jolly Holiday filmed in front of a giant yellow screen. And I love what you say about supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, because it reminded you of the patter songs of your vaudeville days.
It did. And, you know, it was so like those musical theatres where everybody did that kind of rumpty-tum kind of songs, walking back and forth and up and down the stage. And I thought in the days when I was in vaudeville, what good is it doing me? And then, of course, nothing in life, I discover, is wasted. And those years were very useful to me when it came to making Poppins.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word and then you've got a lot to say. But better use it carefully or it could change your life.
For example?
Yes?
One night I said it to me girl, and now me girl's me wife. Oh, and a lovely thing she is too. She's
supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
And a really interesting point you bring to our attention is that the first three films, Mary Poppins, The Americanization of Emily and The Sound of Music, I hadn't realised by the time you finished The Sound of Music, you had made all three, but were waiting for all three to be released.
That's right. I was having this lovely time playing at making movies. And then, of course, within very short order, all three were released. And that's when, you know, one suddenly became a name that people recognized, and there was a lot of publicity. It was quite an assault for a while, but I don't knock it, that's for sure, but it was a learning curve that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, because when we think of the success of Mary Poppins and the Oscar award for you, you'd no idea making The Sound of Music that that was going to be such a success.
No, you can never tell that any movie, you hope that it's not going to disappoint, but you cannot quite guess at the amount of success it might be. Sometimes you hope that it'll be really well received because you enjoy making it so much, but especially the musicals. But I don't know, it's a great treat when something is nominated, but the work itself is actually the biggest pleasure, I think.
When it came to being asked to star in The Sound of Music, was it an immediate yes for you?
Was it an instant yes? No, not exactly. I think I, somewhere in the back of my head, I hoped, and I mean, I wasn't one to pick and choose in those days. I was a rank newcomer. But nevertheless, I wondered if playing two nannies in very short order might typecast me, and to an extent it did. I was worried that people would only think of me in a kind of squeaky clean white bread sort of way, but the body of work these days, thank goodness, has sort of speaks for itself. But at that time it did occur to me that it might be a little difficult, but the pleasure of that movie far outweighed those concerns, and all of us in the movie, of course, decided that we would try to make it as astringent as possible, given the potential saccharine themes that could drown us all. And of course, everybody, including our lovely director, Robert Wise, was acutely aware that Sound of Music had to be as real and as astringent as possible.
Yes, and again, you give us such wonderful detail about the filming of it and about the songs, the seven Von Trapp children already rehearsing by the time you arrived. The first song you say you recorded was My Favourite Things, where, you know, there you were just starting to bond with the kids, I would imagine. And I love your little bit of information about the decision to speak the first phrase as opposed to singing it.
Yes, it was mutually agreed. It came from our musical the man in charge of all the sound, and including the performances and so on, he said, you know, I think it would be nice if you eased into the song and made it part of a dialogue. And I couldn't agree more, because launching into song is kind of somehow didn't feel right, and he hit it exactly right when he suggested that, and I embraced it instantly.
And how was it filming that first song with the seven kids around you?
Well, it was a very good one to begin the movie with. First of all, it's a beautiful song and great fun. And the kids were lovely. And I saw, as nervous as I was, I saw how nervous they were. And so I decided to sort of make it as easy on them as possible, too. And so I teased them a little bit in close-ups and made them smile. And they asked me to sing Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which they'd heard about, but the film hadn't been released when we were filming that. So I was able to share it with them, and they loved it. We bonded very quickly.
Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver-white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favourite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favourite things, and then I don't feel so.
How did you get on initially with the yodeling?
I can't yodel. I still can't, Aidan. But, I faked it, and I guess I faked it well enough, thanks to my kind of high voice. But it's not an easy thing. I have a huge respect for really good yodelers. It's a whole different way of singing, and it's a throwing of the voice and a hardening of the voice and something that I wasn't used to at all.
A certain sadness, too, when you remind us that Edelweiss was the last song Oscar Hammerstein ever wrote.
Yes. Oh, my goodness me. And what a beautiful song. It, when all is said and done, I think it is my favourite song in the film. I've subsequently sung it a lot because I do so enjoy it. And it's no accident, I suppose, that it is my favourite song in the film because, again, it's about home, and the book is called Homework. And home is about everything to do with feeling rooted and set in a place that's warm and embracing and comfortable, whether it be one's real home or one's country or a movie set, really, to be corny.
Yeah, you mentioned some lovely meetings with various names that again made me sort of stop when I was reading this book. For example, you received a surprise invitation from Cole Porter to come for dinner at his home.
Yes, that was completely out of the blue. And I kept thinking, I wonder why he's asking me to come and have supper with him. But my goodness, I mean, I was a huge admirer, and what a thrill. And I do write about that in the book, yeah.
Yeah, I'd forgotten too you got to dance with Gene Kelly in a TV special. That must have been magic.
Yes, it was. And Harry Belafonte, I did a special with him, and many wonderful things that came my way. I was truly a lucky, very lucky lady.
And what a shock about Bette Davis approaching you after the Mary Poppins premiere and saying, "You, my dear, are going to be a very big star."
Yes, I'm not sure if it was Mary Poppins or Sound of Music. I can't remember which one, but she happened to be there, and she came up to me and said those lovely words, and she was terrific and sweet and kind. And of course, her movie image was always that she was much more crisp and somewhat tart in her deliveries, but she was very lovely, and it was an enormous compliment that she paid me.
In the first part of your memoir, you shared a lot, Julie, with the reader about your upbringing, which wasn't always easy. You were very open about that, including shouldering a lot of responsibility for one so young, your stepfather's alcoholism. You very generously, I think, here share with us the follow-up, how you dealt with that, with some very tough issues, and how psychoanalysis helped you hugely.
Well, it did. I was fortunate enough to find and take advantage of a very wonderful psychoanalyst in Los Angeles. And all the while I was making these big and quite daunting movies in terms of the hard work, I was undergoing some analysis and psychotherapy as well. It, in essence, for me, showed me what I didn't need to worry about and what I needed to focus on. Got rid of a lot of garbage, in other words, and really sorted out my head, which is what I needed at that time.
So wonderful. You found that and you unloaded that emotional baggage. That was really important for you.
Well, it was. And also, truthfully, I mean, I was in therapy for a long time. I think I became, hopefully, a better wife, a better mother, and have a better understanding and compassion and things like that. I mean, I did do a lot of learning. That's another reason that the book is called Homework, because I did a lot of learning on myself, about myself.
You also ended up really through that meeting Blake Edwards.
Yes. Not long after I'd started therapy, there we both were at the crossroads on side by side at a crossing on Sunset Boulevard. And that seemed to happen quite often, like three or four times. And so finally he rolled down a window. I didn't know him. And he said, are you going where I've just come from? And it was the street where most of the analysts in town were working. And I said, well, I think so. He said, well, good luck, and rolled on. But then I got a request later to meet him about a script that he was thinking of writing. And I'm afraid he was so charismatic and so adorable and such an interesting gentleman that I tried very hard not to fall in love with him, but I'm afraid I really did, hook, line and sinker.
Well, I'm going to bring it back to Ireland, Julie, because for those of us who might take up the book and flick through to the pictures, we Irish will be delighted to see a couple of photos of you in Carton House in County Kildare, where you were living and filming Darling Lily, co-written and directed by Blake Edwards, which indeed also brought you to Dublin's Gaiety Theatre.
Wonderful memories. First of all, I love that country, your country, and it's the prettiest and the greenest and the most beautiful scenery, and it couldn't have been a lovelier time. And working at that amazing house, which was, I think it is now, deemed one of the more important homes in the area, along with all the other great homes, it was such a joy to imagine what it must have been like in the old days, and how, you know, there was a tunnel underneath the house for the where the servants in the old days would pass, so they didn't interrupt the view in front of the great French windows and so on.
And I suppose being back in the Gaiety Theatre was another reminder again, coming back to your vaudeville days.
Well, yes, it was in fact a real theatre, as much like many that I'd worked in, and it brought back memories front and centre the minute I walked into it, the smell of it, the feel of it. I think I write about that, the gels in the lights, the smell of the dust and makeup and the curtains, and it just brought it all back to me.
What comes across very much in your book also is that you just love being a mother. You've co-written this book with your daughter, Emma. You speak about your two stepchildren adopting two more children. It's a role I think you love more than anything.
I think so. Well, family really is essential for me, and a sense of continuity and family and home and all that that represents, whether it's my singing voice or our home or my kids especially, it matters. And I couldn't do all that I have done, I guess, without being rooted in that first. And I could do anything as long as they were safe and well, but if they weren't, it was very hard to concentrate on anything else.
The time period of this book is 1963 to 1986. Why did you stop at 1986?
I think it would have taken another 4 years to write. As it was, it took 3 years to pull it all together. And I guess, to some extent, it's how I view the sort of major stepping stones in my life. And, you know, my beginnings were a debut when I was 12, and then all the years in music hall and vaudeville, and then the years on Broadway. And then came the move to Hollywood, which is the second stepping stone, really, and or the third, I guess, if you think about vaudeville as one, Broadway is two, and then Hollywood is three. And I guess four might be whatever is left over, which is considerable as I finish this book, returning to Broadway after 30 years being absent from Broadway.
And of course, you talk about Victor Victoria, and Broadway beckons for the stage version of that. So does this mean there's another book beckoning?
Oh, gosh. Ask me in about a year's time, because I'm still recovering from this one.
Well, as I say, it makes for a wonderful read. I just want to come full circle. We began talking about Mary Poppins when you won the Oscar, that you just weren't comfortable having the Oscar on show for so long. At what point did you embrace that success?
Oh, I don't know, actually, when I decided I'd like to have it up on a shelf. For quite a long while, I kept it in my attic. I was modest about it, didn't want to show off, felt that it was a great gift that I'd been given, but more perhaps as a welcome to Hollywood rather than the accomplishment or a job well done. It was hard to believe that a first film would, you know, give me an Oscar. I never expected it, and it was a complete surprise when my name was announced. So I think I say in my acceptance speech, you certainly know, you Americans know how to spoil a girl or make her feel at home. I can't remember what I said. And I felt that way. It was a welcome. And so I kept it very quiet and packed it away. And then one day, several years later, I thought, I'd like to have it up on a shelf after all.
Well, good for you. Dame Julie Andrews, I could talk to you for hours, as you well know, but you've been so generous with your time. And all I can say is I hope you come and visit us again soon.
Well, I'd love it. And I'd love for us our paths to cross again too, Aideen. And thank you for a lovely interview.
Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could.